from WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack. What a week it has been on the talk show. We discussed bail reform, gun violence, music, poetry, and there was even a conversation with Governor Andrew Cuomo. Lots for you to check out on our website, wxxinews.org/connections, or wherever you get your podcasts. Let's start this week's episode with part of the interview with Governor Cuomo. He broke some news regarding funding for homeowners along Lake Ontario, and he also discussed gun laws. When he was last on our program, we asked Governor Cuomo if he was willing to go further with gun laws than he has in the past. We referenced an interview with Grand Island Supervisor Nate McMurray, who called for the ban and confiscation of assault-style weapons. The governor wasn't in favor of that idea at that time, so I asked him if the recent mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton changed his perspective. Here's his response.
We have banned assault weapons in the state of New York. 6 years ago, after the Sandy Hook massacre, where we all saw school children killed, we passed the best gun safety law in the United States of America. And it bans assault weapons. It bans high-capacity magazines. It calls for universal background checks and a mental health database. Just to show you what it's accomplished, we now have 100,000 seriously mentally ill people on the mental health database that could have bought a gun in New York, Megan, who can't now buy a gun because we have a mental health database. And we did ban assault weapons. Why? Because an assault weapon, the risk outweighs the reward. They are designed to kill. I am not anti-gun. I own a gun. Hunting is a great tradition. Passing on a gun to a child is a great tradition. But an assault weapon, which is what was used in El Paso, it's what was used in Ohio, they are designed to kill the largest number of people in the shortest period of time. So we did that 6 years ago. And I, as a matter of fact, today I'm calling on all the Democratic presidential candidates to adopt our law, in essence. And I'm saying to them, if they want the votes of New Yorkers, when they come to New York, I'm going to ask them straight out, do you support our laws? I call it the Safe America Pledge. We've had it for 6 years. It works. There's no legitimate gun owner who's come to me in 6 years and said, you infringed on my right. Seriously mentally ill people can't buy guns, and former felons don't have guns, and that's why you need a background check so you know who's buying the gun. But no legal, legitimate owner has complained to me that their rights have been infringed. And I'm going to ask every presidential candidate, you want to show the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans? Agree to this law. Because I'll tell you the truth, I can't even tell you what the position of the Democratic presidential candidates are. And I follow this stuff every day. And if you're just leading your life, I don't know who could tell what the Democrats believe and stand for among the group. So I'm doing that. Confiscation is different. We have 6 years ago banned the sale of assault weapons and regulated what you could do if you owned an assault weapon. Confiscation is the piece that we did not do. And I don't even know how you would do that. And what is the need to do it if they are already banned 6 years ago?
Next, a conversation about the personal effects of gun violence. Toni Nelson is the founder of M Square Foundation for Peace and Social Change. She started the group after her husband and son were murdered years apart in separate incidents in Rochester. Toni is a gun owner with a concealed carry permit. She's also an activist for responsible gun ownership. In this clip, she shares her loss and how these experiences have fueled her activism.
My husband, I call him Mike, and because we had to differentiate. So when Michael was born, Mike had to be Mike, not Michael. My mom said so. So they were so much alike, considering the fact that Mike was killed when Michael was 4. So he didn't really know his dad, but they were the goofiest, you know, they just made you laugh. You know, they were silly and fun. You know, they always lifted me up, both of them, you know. Mike was my high school sweetheart. We got married right out of high school. He went into the Marine Corps. My son was born in Camp Lejeune down in North Carolina. And then, you know, I moved back home. So shortly after Mike came back from Desert Storm, he was murdered on the corner of Bay and 7th in Rochester in what they call mistaken identity, which I don't know what that's about. Like, if you're going to shoot somebody, you should know who you're shooting. Not that you should shoot somebody, but at least know who the heck you're shooting. He was 24, almost 25, and he was getting ready to go back into the reserves, the Marine Corps reserves. So it was a loss. It was a big loss. But I was so young, being 23. I don't really think I processed it because I had a son to raise. You know what I mean? So all my energy and effort went into that. Fast forward 2014, and my son, who was also 24, almost 25, when he was murdered in a what they call wrong place, wrong time, which I certainly don't understand that one. If you're somewhere and not bothering anybody, in actuality, my son was sleeping when he was murdered. Mm. When that happened, I got pissed. You took away my baby. Like, I carried this child, I nurtured this child, I raised this child, and for absolutely no reason that I would understand, he's gone. And it brought a lot of things to the forefront. You see the news, you see what goes on in the news, but you don't feel it. And when your child is taken, you feel it. You feel a lot of emotions. You feel a lot of emotions. So I had to do something. I didn't know what. It took a little while. I went through a bout of depression. I'm still in therapy for it. I recommend therapy if it's for you. But we decided, and when I say we, there's a group of people that have supported me so much. We decided to start M Squared, Foundation for Peace and Social Change, because we want to change the mindset of young people growing up. When you respect and love yourself, you'll respect and love others. And when your life is valuable, you'll value other people's lives. And that's what we want to get across to young people. We want to work with them and their families, because if you work with young people and you don't change the mindset of the people in their homes, it kind of doesn't work. But I'm really passionate about it. I met Charon, and I just love her and the work she does. I also work with a group called Rise Up Rochester. They have a support group for people who have lost someone. And Michael, they call him Big Mike, which I don't call him Big Mike because his dad was Big Mike, but they don't know that. They call him Big Mike. He was 6'3". He was like 300 pounds. He's a big guy, but he was like the big teddy bear of the neighborhood. And I mean, literally in a 12 block radius, everybody knew him. He would pull people's garbage cans to the front yard when it was garbage day. He would take my lawnmower and cut everybody's grass, and then I'd wonder why I didn't have any gas, you know, in my lawnmower. And all the when he passed away, a lot of the ladies in the street said, "He always cut my grass." I'm like, "I know. That's why my mowers were always broke." And, you know, it's like, I'm like, "Well, what happened? I only do my grass like every other week." But he was a big help in the neighborhood businesses. He would go up and help out in the businesses for a couple dollars, you know, just pocket change and just help out people. And that's how people knew him, by his beautiful, infectious smile and just being that guy in the neighborhood. They know if they were moving something or needed help with something, they could call Big Mike. And I'm finding that I don't have a lot of street cred, but when I say I'm Big Mike's mom, mm-hmm. Okay, no problem. You know, we can help out. I'm like, really? That it just amazed me, the amount of people at his funeral. Like, I don't even know that many people. And people that I've met at, you know, when Sam's Club was here, there was a cashier and he favored my son, and me and my daughter were whispering. He's like, "Oh, you're talking about Big Mike?" And I'm like, "You know my son?" "Well, no, but they talk about him at Job Corps." "Really?" You know, so it's just amazing to me, the people that he touched. He touched so many people in 24 short years. And I am intent on keeping his legacy alive. You know, he deserves that. Mm-hmm. And he didn't get to finish it out, so mom's going to do that. As long as I have a breath, I'm going to represent my son in the best light possible and help as many people as I can along the way.
The conversation with Tony Nelson and others is one that I would definitely recommend you check out on our website, because there was a moment between Undersheriff Corey Brown, who was also a guest, and Tony when they discussed firearms safety training. As I mentioned earlier, Tony does own a gun, but she hasn't received training for it. Turns out that's very common. And the undersheriff said that, in his personal opinion, anyone who purchases a firearm should do some kind of mandatory training. So that conversation is very interesting, and you might want to check it out. We'll close the week with a conversation about the classical music industry. The Gateways Music Festival wraps up this weekend. It celebrates classical musicians and composers of African descent. Nationwide, less than 2% of orchestra members are African American. In this clip, you'll hear Herb Smith, a trumpeter with the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra and member of the Artistic Programs Committee for the Gateways Music Festival. Here he is discussing why the trumpet became his instrument of choice. And it all began when he was in the fourth grade.
Here you are in the room with like other fourth graders and parents, and the band director plays all the instruments, you know, and he plays the trumpet, he plays the trombone, tuba, flute, and you kind of just listen to them and everyone gets to pick the instrument they want. So I remember looking at the trombone thinking, man, that's too big, you know. Tuba, that's just way too big. Flute, too small. Trumpet was kind of like, you know, it's shiny. It's right in the middle. It's just right. I liked the sound of it and picked it and just was instantly had a liking to it. Just immediately started playing and was like had a decent proficiency to play. And I haven't stopped playing yet. I keep saying when I stop liking the trumpet, that's when I'll quit. I mean, I just love the instrument.
I remember a very similar experience, listening to someone demonstrate instruments, giving students a chance to think about what you wanted to do. And I was probably a third grader who wanted to pick up a viola or a violin and was frustrated that I couldn't play it, you know, like a high-end fiddler right away. And
right.
I quit.
Right.
Did you find yourself with the trumpet kind of taken to it pretty quickly? I mean, was it easy?
No, it wasn't easy, but it was just, I don't know, just something about it I liked. You know, it was written in the stars. I don't know. It was just, I just loved it. I mean, my daughter started to play the violin, and I didn't make her practice. Like, my mom always brags, I never made him practice. He just practiced on his own. So it was just a thing for me. So when my daughter played violin, she really wasn't into it. So I just allowed that to be, you know, that wasn't the thing for her. Where some parents get in there and practice, you know, you got, and some people then take to the instrument. But for my daughter, I wanted it to be just a natural thing the way that it was for me.
I was going to ask you if there is sort of a one technique is better for a parent who wants a kid to get into it than another. It sounds like you think some kids will take to more of that sternness. You're going to go to this piano lesson. You're going to go to this. Whereas others, if you do that, the second they can pull the ripcord and get out of it, they will.
Right, right. I mean, I know, like, I was in Japan a few years ago with the Eastman Wind Ensemble, and we would do concerts. And in Japan at that time, every kid had to take an instrument. Every single kid. So as a wind ensemble coming into these cities, it was jam-packed with people. We'd come out and we were giving autographs. I mean, it was just so many kids. And when you do that, you throw a huge net. And then the kids that have that natural feeling for it will take to it. And the ones that don't will go away.
And become audience members.
Exactly.
And donors and supporters.
Exactly. Right. Because they've had that experience. They have had that music. And that's exactly what you're saying. But when you're in a situation where there's just hundreds of thousands of kids that are not getting the chance to have that music education, then there are your numbers for why only 1 in 2 people are going to orchestra concerts. We are missing the net. of kids that have, that may have the ability to play an instrument and therefore also be supporters of music. There's some kind of study that says you can't start violin in ninth grade and be a professional violinist. There's like certain things that happen. I'm sure that there's stories of people that have, you know, but like there's certain, like there's, someone said you have to play the instrument for certain amount of hours before you get to a certain age in order to be a professional musician. So it's like once that's gone, it's gone. Did I answer the question?
Yeah, I think you did, and I'm heartened to hear that you didn't feel either discriminated or even, again, that assumption on the ceiling, that no one looked at you and said, are you sure you want to be playing this when, you know, some of the stereotypical things that African-American kids and young adults might be assumed the kind of careers that we lay out for kids. So, like Lee said, I mean, this is partially it's about helping people see themselves in a broader range of possibilities.
Right.
Is it a social justice issue for you?
Yeah, for me, this festival really shows an African-American kid a different path. The perception and the view of African-Americans in America, men especially, there's only a certain amount of paths. I mean, there are always doctors and lawyers, there's that, but like the ones that are paraded on the screen, there's like a few, you know, there's the sports, there's the R&B or rapper or something like that. There's only a few. And to see an orchestra of all African-American players, a child to see that, to me, which is, I'm like, I never saw that when I was growing up. You know, I just never did. And to see that, it's like, wow, I could actually do that. Like, that's my uncle. Like, my uncle looks like that. Like, that's my brother. That's my dad up there playing. You know, so I think that this is something that can open the eyes of African-American kids, but to all people.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. We are also on the WXXI mobile app. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Megan Mack. Kevin Dawson will be back from vacation next week. We'll talk to you then. Happy weekend.